It's the Jane the Ripper edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Too Much Water in the Oceans, part two of our interview with Seth Klein. This week, taxes, and a look at the mythology of Jack the Ripper. Let's begin episode 168.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So Ethan, it's recently been brought to my attention about a performance artist in Japan who thought, well, he was a he, thought that he might become one with all people by removing one aspect that sort of separates us all, his genitals. Their genitals. And he's no longer a he. Unlike others who have had surgery like this, there's no attempt to become, you know, a she. He was simply just trying to become androgynous. So, okay, it's an interesting social experiment, you might say. But, you know, it does point out there are certain difficulties in our language when we try and refer to someone without sort of gender terms. Now, if he had stopped at that, again, this would have been interesting, but a so what kind of story. Well, again, unlike other people who have had their genitals removed by surgery, they had them placed in sterile bags, frozen, and safe for future use. And no, this isn't some weird sort of pseudo-necrophiliac sort of thing. No, he was saving them for dinner. Mayo Sagayama, the artist in question, then went on to Twitter and placed this ad, quote, "Please retwitter, I am offering my male genitals, full penis, testicle, and scrotum, for a meal for 100,000 yen, that's about $1,200. I am Japanese, the organs were surgically removed at the age of 22. I was tested for free of venereal disease. The organs are normally functioning. I was not receiving female hormone treatment. The full length of his erection was average. First interesting buyer will get them, or I will consider selling them as a group for a group dinner. We'll prepare and cook them at the buyer's request and at their chosen location. If you're interested, please contact me by email. Six people paid for the privilege of dining on his cooked organs. And he had them in, what is it, ham chablis century banquet. So I guess he kind of hooked up like a roast ham style on April 13th. Three men and three women paid for the honor, although one of the men was not quite up to the experience. So it was a dinner of five, which kind of reminds me of a TV show. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, Ethan, called Come Dine With Me. Those who have enjoyed the show, maybe keep your eyes open. You never know. This may be an episode in the making. If this was sort of an isolated event, again, it would be a little weird, but there actually seems to be kind of a trend. Recently this year, on Dutch TV show, the host had part of their buttocks removed and had them essentially pan-fried on air where they ate them. There was also a case a few years ago about a German who put an ad in the paper saying, I would like someone to eat me once I'm dead. So it was sort of a necrophilia and sort of, and again, genitalia were involved in this. It's a weird thing, but, so there's two things that kind of came to my mind. Well, of course, excluding the ick factor. But one, you know, is this kind of cannibalism wrong? I mean, the subject of the source of the meat, the people in general, were at least far more willing than the source of your bovine steak. You know, I mean, the cow didn't say yes, whereas these people actually said, yeah, sure, have them. And there doesn't seem to be any real harm done. And then, of course, the other question that comes to mind is sort of this showmanship. Of the whole thing. I mean, cannibalism as art. There's a meme sort of that, you know, our tastes, our entertainment tastes anyhow, come to be bored with the current fare. So we look for more and more extreme entertainments. Historians have noted that, you know, in the times of the gladiator circuses and that the games, as time went on, became more and more extreme, more and more radical. So maybe this is just sort of a modern manifestation of that sort of genre.
Well, I mean, the question, I guess, depends on, has this person undergone a psychiatric evaluation anytime soon? But, I mean, it's sort of one of those weird loopholes of the law. I suppose that if you say you're willing to have part of your body removed and eaten, that's fine. I mean, people do other stuff with their bodies, so I don't know. It's a very, very strange thing, and one of the reasons why I'm probably not into modern art.
It could be. Well, you know, and I should preface this. I mean, there are a number of cases on the book, sort of people who were insane. I mean, the Jeffrey Dahmers of the world would not fall into this sort of category, right?
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. There's some people think instinctual taboo to eat other people. So there's that aspect of it. I mean, there's one, people wanting to give up their parts to feed other people. Mm-hmm. And then there are the other people who say, I haven't had a piece of human ham in a long time. It might be good. Which I guess plays into the sort of, there's a bifurcated of interest. And then, of course, as I say, the whole, let's put this on TV and let's make this sort of a media event, which is the whole...
Well, the slow decline of reality TV, I suppose. But, well, we actually have a great show here on Radio Free Thinker, despite there'll be no consuming of human products.
Well, not that you will see.
Or hear. Yeah. But let's get on with things. Don, you're going to tell us about water.
Water. There's been a long mystery about the oceans of the globe. They're getting bigger. Now, many of our listeners will say, well, of course, it's global warming. And they would be right to a degree. Thanks to thermal expansion, the oceans have risen by 1.8 millimeters a year. The problem or mystery is that the global warming, melting glaciers, etc., only actually account for 60% of this expansion. So where is the rest coming from? In a recent report in Nature Geoscience, a team of researchers think they have cracked the problem. Food. Well, food largely in the form of grass, like rice, wheat, and soya. Okay, soya is not technically a grass, but it is a food. As human populations have increased exponentially, we've had to rely on ever-intensive agriculture to feed these mouths. One of the tools to do this is irrigation, and not just the kind that diverts existing waterways, but the type that drills deep into the earth where vast amounts of ancient water can be found in aquifers. There exists underground vast oceans of water stored in these aquifers that have been cut off from the surface for millions and millions of years. Usually, the caves like these structures, they're usually in their like cave-like structures, but more likely they're in porous rock formations where the water is stored. Until recently, about 50 to 100 years ago, these aquifers were become available to humans, Up until about 50 to 100 years ago, the aquifers that were available were the ones near the surface. And it's important these ones, because they are relatively close to the surface, will refill from natural water seeping into the system. Those aquifers, again, refill all the time. The ones we're dealing with is the ones that are being dug deeper and deeper. Because as technology improves, we are able to tap into these isolated aquifers that, as I say, have been cut off from their surface for thousands to millions of years. Notably, those under India and the United States, where water has sort of been out of circulation but has now been coming to the surface and been adding to the oceans thanks to our irrigation of crops and the use of urban settlements. Places like Los Angeles would not exist if it was not through huge irrigation, although largely its irrigation is the classic re-diverting of dams. So this amount actually accounts for almost 0.7 millimeters a year, which over time is a lot, and we're talking over the entire globe. The most notable importance of this is sort of threefold. First, by accelerating the decline of coastlines, they are gradually submerging populations underwater. It will simply be one of those sleeping giants of global warming, but pretty soon you're going to wake up in New York and need water wings just to get to work. Almost 70% of humanity lives along the coast, and it's expected that about half that number will be forced to relocate. So as I say, places like London, New York, and more locally, Richmond, will be underwater by century's close. Another effect is that one of the less mentioned greenhouse gases is water vapor. As more water is available, it can be evaporated into the water, amplifying the greenhouse effect, resulting in more, of course, evaporation, resulting in an increase of the cycle. Perhaps the last effect, and one ironically will limit the other ones, as I mentioned, is that these aquifers are finite. That is, because they are not being refilled from the top, they will eventually empty. This means it will affect its effects on the climate will end, and accordingly, many researchers believe that relatively soon, 20 to 50 years, as most of these aquifers dry out, it will have the run-on effect that agriculture itself will begin to die out because there will be no water for them to the modern form of irrigation will just no longer be there. So the knock-on effect is that you will also be losing millions and millions of people because they will literally starve to death because there'll be no water for the crops.
Hmm. That sounds bad.
Overall, I think it will be bad, but there is an upside. As a first world nation, and first world, I do not mean Mercury, we will actually probably not suffer nearly as much. But of course, as a good humanist, I don't think that means we should care any less. I mean, a lot of people have been noticing how much nicer our weather has been. You know, it's been a little warm, but I mean, what was May weather has now moved up to February, and that sort of knock-on effect. The increased water in the atmosphere will actually help compensate some of the drying effects you're going to get on the prairies. Prairies were originally desert, and they go through sort of that cycle. So there are some positive things to it, but overall, it's going to be quite negative. But it's really interesting how scientists said, hey, listen, we could jump to the assumption that all the expansion of the water's oceans is due to heat expansion, and climate change denialists will say, aha, but look, it doesn't quite match the way you want. The science wins out in the end because they say, okay, you're right, there's an anomaly here, we can't explain it, let's do a little digging, and eventually science answers its own questions.
Right. Well, you know, the interesting thing as well is that not only are the oceans going to get bigger in terms of volume, but they're also going to get bigger in terms of geographically how big they are, because I believe the Pacific Ocean is actually expanding, and I think the Atlantic is the one that's retracting.
So they're all expanding.
Yeah.
And more importantly, as you mentioned, the volume, the water level rises, right?
Yeah. What we should do is drill deep holes in the ocean so the water will go deeper, and that way it won't flood the cities.
Well, you do jest, but some people have kind of suggested to do this sort of sequestration. The only problem with that is, again, where these huge aquifers exist. So essentially, there are now big holes in the ground where you could put this sort of extra water. But these are in the same places where they took the water out because they were deserts in the first place.
Hmm.
So you would have to sort of truck the water there. And I mean, sure, if you're into this huge geoengineering sort of project, that would be an interesting project to do. No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, it was a good shot. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. When we come back, we'll have part two of our interview with Seth Klein. So stay tuned for that.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
This May in Discorder, sit down for a chat with local thrash punk sensations New Sensei. Get well acquainted with Peace before their new album drops. Find out if Weed the Band is better than The Substance. And discover the response from members of Breastronaut on the controversies surrounding bands and crowdsourced funding. As always in Discorder, get your healthy dose of Venue News, Filmstrip, take a look at our beautiful calendar, browse the always-changing CITR program guide, tack up bits of Mark DeLong's art project on your bedroom walls, take in some reviews of music both recorded and live, and all the other goodies you know and love. Pick up your beautiful and free copy of Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, don't forget to check out Discorder at discorder.ca. Discorder, that magazine from CITR, supporting local music for over 25 years.
This guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello again, listeners, as we begin the second of a three-part series with Seth Klein. Seth Klein is director of Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives here in BC. He has graciously agreed to share his knowledge and opinion on a number of policy issues, such as austerity, taxation, and inequality in BC, Canada, and abroad. This week, we're going to focus on taxes and taxation policy. Hello again, Seth.
Hi.
Death and taxes are supposed to be two unavoidables of life. Death is. However, taxes seem to be another thing. We have sin taxes, income taxes, gas taxes, and of course, GST, PST, and HST. Unlike most other nations with consumption taxes, it's sort of incorporated into the price, whereas here it's listed as a separate item on our bill, as if the Canadian government likes to rub our noses in the tax. I think it serves to vilify taxes and to ensure that to the Canadian public sees government as oppressive and taxes as ever present. BC is currently bracing itself for another major tax change as we dismantle the HST. Let's start with a basic question, one often exploited in the United States. When we say taxes, again, we seem to think income taxes, GST. Is that all there is? How else does the government earn money?
There are many different kinds of taxes. On the individual side, as you say, there's income taxes, sales taxes, property taxes, carbon taxes in British Columbia. Then there's the corporate income taxes. But if you looked, for example, in the BC budget, you would also see resource royalties as an important source of income. It used to traditionally be forestry, but these days it's more so natural gas royalties. These are rents that private corporations are paying for accessing what is a publicly owned resource. There's transfers from other levels of government. There's transfers from Crown corporations and the money that they make, which speaks to the fact that sometimes it makes sense for us to create an enterprise collectively, call it a Crown corporation, and it can be a source of income to the public treasury as well.
But Crown corporations are always supposed to be inefficient, isn't that true?
So the saying goes, but we in British Columbia have had Crown corporations historically that have been a very important source of income, like BC Hydro, like ICBC, even while providing us with among the lowest electricity rates and among the lowest car insurance rates in North America.
I would agree. One of the things, though, that I'm thinking, people often say, well, I want to pay less taxes, and not realizing that ultimately they do sort of pay it with things like user fees, or, you know, when you go to get your license, they raise the price of how much it costs to get your license. So it's, you're paying one way or the other, it seems.
Yeah. Well, first of all, just I would just push back a little bit on your first point. I actually think a lot of people do get this. You know, everyone likes to gripe about their taxes, and if given a choice, they'd like to pay less tax if that could come without a price. But in the polling that I've looked at, you actually see a public that is prepared to pay more in taxes. They do understand the connection between taxes and the things that we provide for one another together. And if they felt like paying more would address key social and environmental problems, they would be willing to pay more. That's tempered somewhat by a perception that is well-grounded, that the system is not fair the way it should be, that not everyone is pulling their weight the way that they should be. And so that complicates matters, and it complicates people's perceptions and their willingness to ante more into the collective pot. But very often, as you were just saying, these questions aren't about, you know, do you want to pay more or less? Nothing in society is free. And so it's just at its heart, the taxation question really is, what are the things that we want to pay for on our own? And what are the things that we want to pay for together? Our experience as a society, when you look at things like healthcare, is that there's plenty of things that are fine to leave to the private sector. But there are other things where our experience tells us we provide these things to each other more equitably and more efficiently when we do it together through our taxes.
We hear in the news that the wealthy people, and I must admit this is usually in the American news, but that wealthy people, the 1%, if you will, actually account for the majority of taxes collected. Is this true? And is this reflective of the real state of things?
The 1% don't account for a majority of the taxes. The top 10% account for a majority of taxes, or thereabout, slightly, but only because they have so much money. Those statistics that you hear are a reflection of the fact that we've seen such an explosion in inequality. In the 10 years before the recession in Canada, a third of all of the income growth went to the top 1%. So, you know, Do they pay more in taxes as a result? Yes, of course. But the way that we appropriately measure taxes isn't in total dollars. When we think about taxes and tax fairness, what we're interested in is actually what share of your income are you paying in taxes? And most Canadians have the perception that we have a tax regime that's broadly speaking progressive, meaning the more income you make, not only do you pay more dollars in taxes, but you pay a higher rate of your income, a higher percent. And that's not actually true. The income tax system is progressive. We have a few tax brackets, and so it's progressive. But all the other taxes that we pay, sales, property, payroll, et cetera, are regressive, meaning they hit lower income households harder. And when you roll them all together and look at who's paying what, as we've done at the CCPA, what you find in Canada is that the top 1% actually pay the lowest overall tax rate in the country, less than the top, than the bottom 10%. And in the BC context, because we've looked at this as well, we have an out and out regressive tax system, which means it's like a downward sloping line, if you will, on a chart. The more money you make in British Columbia, the lower your overall tax rate. You'd be paying more in income taxes, but when you look at all taxes, and because we've shifted from income taxes to sales taxes and other forms of fees, the wealthy have actually been paying a declining share.
From what I've also heard, personal income tax makes up a significant share of the tax revenue, but that if you go back to the 50s or 60s, about a third of government income came from corporations. Now it's closer to about 5%. Is that true? And is it sort of a red herring to worry about corporate taxes? I mean, they are people too, aren't they?
Oh, well, I think we should be worried about corporate taxes. I can't remember the federal rates off the top of my head, but I can tell you that in British Columbia, corporate taxes, corporate income taxes account for about 8% of government revenues, of taxation revenues alone, actually. If it was all revenues, it would be less than that. And this, just to give you some examples of the shifts that we've seen in the last 10 years, you know, the Liberals pride themselves on this decline in the personal income tax rate, and there was. Their reliance on personal income taxes between 2000 and 2010 dropped by about a third. But they actually now get more money from sales taxes than they do from personal income taxes. And one of the stats I find staggering, they get more money now from MSP premiums than they do from corporate income taxes. Wow. And I think that's outrageous, actually, because the MSP premium is the most regressive tax in our whole system. It's not only that people are all paying the same rate. After a basic income threshold, everyone's paying the same dollar amount. A family with $50,000 is paying the same amount as a family with $500,000. And that's an ever-growing share of government revenues. And they've been increasing it by 6% a year.
Well, that also shows there's a huge difference between sort of the technical tax rate and the effective tax rate, right? I mean, like everyone's sort of famous to hear about how Warren Buffett says that he pays less taxes than his secretary.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things going on here. So first of all, there's this shift that's happened from the corporate sector to individuals, and then from upper income individuals to middle and modest income individuals. And what you're now raising around effective tax rates is really important, because people walk around thinking that they pay a certain tax rate because that's what it looks like on paper. You know, they fill out their tax form and they think, oh, my rate is 7% for my BC income taxes. But the system is filled with all of these deductions and credits. And you have to account for those to get at your effective tax rate. But now there's some deductions that most people use, like, you know, RSP deductions. Well, actually, most people don't use that one, or charitable deductions or childcare deductions. But most of the tax deductions in our system can only be taken advantage of by the wealthy and by businesses. And so when you look at the effective tax rate, it becomes much less progressive.
So, okay, I'm going to put on my sort of Stephen Colbert hat for the moment. But isn't that actually good? I mean, people have argued that tax breaks, the wealthy and corporations in particular, create jobs, and that, you know, it increases tax revenue because you have more money in the economy that's being spent, the sort of trickle down effect. I mean, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's not true. That's how the argument goes, but it's not borne out by the evidence. For example, look at the Canadian context for a moment, but this is borne out in British Columbia as well. We have seen a dramatic reduction in corporate income tax rates federally and provincially over the last 10 years. The whole object of the exercise was that if we lowered the corporate income tax rate, we would see a commensurate increase in investment in jobs, because that's what we actually want, right? And you actually look at the data and it's not there. Federally, across the country, the corporate sector is sitting on $500 billion in cash. They're not investing what they're saving. They have not reciprocated with their side of the deal here. And the same is true in British Columbia. And across the industrialized countries, by the way, if you were to plot the overall level of taxes against the overall level of economic performance, according to, you know, the World Economic Competitive Index, you know what you would see? You would see nothing. There is no correlation between the overall level of taxes and economic performance.
So the whole story that, you know, we have one of the lowest and quote unquote most competitive tax rates, if we mess with that, it would be doom and gloom for our economy.
Yeah. Well, we do have among the lowest corporate taxes, and we've gotten for it. All it does is starve the Treasury of money that it otherwise would have had to meet other needs and indeed to invest in things that would have an economic benefit.
This may be a bit tangential, but Canada has an exorbitant amount of foreign ownership in its industries. How much of that plays into this is money sort of leaving the country to corporate headquarters offshore or in other countries?
No, that's a real issue. In fact, there's an irony to the fact that, you know, Canada has a much lower corporate income tax rate than the United States does. But if you are a corporation that is operating in both countries, the way U.S. tax rules work, if you can show the Americans that you're paying a higher tax rate than you would be if you were in the States, then you don't have to pay taxes. But if you're paying a lower tax rate somewhere else, the United States claims the difference. So, you know, we've given a bunch of these corporations a tax break, and instead of it resulting in some economic benefits, it just means that they're paying a higher tax bill to the U.S.
So how can we improve things? I mean, I've heard of fair trade, but is there such a thing as fair taxes?
Yeah, well, we have proposed what we call a fair tax commission. In many respects, coming out of the whole fiasco of the HST, I think it's a real shame that we had this huge debate and a referendum all about a single tax. It would be far better if we had a really broad public conversation about the whole tax system, in which we put the whole tax regime on the table, all taxes, personal taxes, corporate taxes, resource royalties, and we engage the public in a deliberation about what do we want to pay for together and how do we want to raise it, and allowed people to engage in trade-offs in an interesting discussion the way they did in the conversation on health a few years ago, or the Citizens Assembly on electoral reform a few years before that. And I think if we trusted people to engage in a deliberation like that, we would be pleased with the outcome.
Well, I hope I have the same optimistic. I noticed what happened to proportional representation didn't seem to take hold, even though it was very popular in many ways. I'd like to thank you for, again, showing up in our virtual studio and giving us this insightful, informative discussion about taxation. I would ask you, is there any parting message you'd like to send to our audience regarding taxes and how they can be involved in these economic issues?
Well, I would just say that if you look at the key challenges before us, whether it's rising to the challenge of climate change or ending poverty, I would say something that most politicians would be reluctant to say, which is that we actually need to increase taxes and revenues. We need to put more into the collective pot to actually rise to these challenges, and we can afford to do it. And spending it on meeting those challenges would actually be good for the economy. And so we just need to figure out what the most fair and effective way is to raise those revenues. And that's something our office has been working on and will continue to work on. And people can find that on our site, which is policyalternatives.ca.
Thank you very much. And I agree with you that we are much stronger united than divided. And that will be our discussion for next week when we talk about inequality.
Join us for Vancouver's third annual Complaints Choir. In this hilarious community project, participants sing in a litany of complaints, from money woes to condos, bad government to bad habits. Come out on Sunday, June the 2nd, to this free outdoor event taking place around the Mount Pleasant area. Check out www.newmusic.org for more details. Sponsored by CITR 101.9 FM.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Back here on Radio Freethinker. So many of our listeners are probably aware of the story of Jack the Ripper, the subject of our next segment. But for those of you who are not aware, allow me to fill you in on the details. Now, before I do that, I do want to warn any listeners who are a bit squeamish or don't like to hear about serial killers, you know, feel free to fast forward a little bit.
Yes, now that you've given that warning, Ethan, we have Miss Sarah Jane Parker in here, who will now demonstrate the Jack the Ripper technique live on air as to... No.
Let's skip the live demonstration. I mean, plus they can't see it anyway, so... Jack the Ripper is the meme name for the killer who committed the Whitechapel murders in 1888. Whitechapel, of course, is a district in London, still exists today. However, back in 1888, it was the notorious slum area that was frequented by prostitutes and sex workers. London's Metropolitan Police Service estimated that there were 1,200 prostitutes and about 62 brothels in Whitechapel. In addition, Whitechapel was also sort of a poor immigrant slum, and because it was very economically depressed... And, of course, it was 1888. Crime was common and typically unsolved.
I imagine the police didn't spend a lot of time wasting their time on these people who are probably better off dead anyhow.
Yeah. Thank God we don't have that problem today.
No.
So, Whitechapel, already a bad place to be on a good day, but it got a whole lot worse once a series of grisly's murders started happening. Now, there's 11 separate murders stretching from April 3rd, 1888 to February 13th, 1891. And the Metropolitan Police Service investigated them, and they sort of came up with the collective name, the Whitechapel Murders. However, because of the frequency of violence that the prostitutes were facing in the area, it's kind of unclear how many murders can be attributed to Jack the Ripper. Five of the 11 Whitechapel murders, which have come to become known as the Canonical Five, are widely believed to be the work of the Ripper. And this is because of the particular way in which those murders took place, the level of violence that was very, very consistent, as was the treatment of the victims after they were killed. Those five kills all seem to have in common very deep throat slashes, abdominal and genital area mutilation, removal of internal organs, and progressive facial mutilations all begin to be considered the distinctive features of Jack the Ripper's modus operandi.
When you say progressive facial mutilation, do you mean they were getting worse as time went on?
Yeah, exactly. So the Canonical Five include Mary Ann Nicholas, Anne Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Jane Kelly. Nichols' body was discovered at about 3:40 a.m. on Friday 31st of August of 1888 in Bucks Row, which is now Durwood Street for people who live in Whitechapel. The throat was severed deeply by two cuts, and the lower part of the abdomen was ripped open by a deep, jagged wound. And then several other incisions on the abdomen were caused by the same knife.
How did they determine it was the same knife? I imagine the forensic science at this time was a bit questionable, but most investigators believe it was an accurate judgment for the time?
Well, actually, the interesting thing with the Jack the Ripper murders is that because they were so well publicized and people were, you know, they wanted these murders resolved, the police were actually pioneering a lot of new forensic techniques. So as we'll see, a lot of what they were doing is kind of state-of-the-art for the time investigation. Now, the next victim, Chapman, her body was discovered about 6 a.m. on Saturday the 8th, September 1888, near a doorway of a backyard. Her throat was severed by two cuts, the abdomen was slashed entirely open, and it was later discovered that the uterus had been removed. At the inquest, one witness described seeing Chapman at about 5:30 a.m. with a dark-haired man of, quote, shabby, genteel appearance. Stride and Eddowes were killed in the early morning of Sunday the 30th, September 1888. Stride's body was discovered at about 1 a.m. The cause of death was one clear-cut incision, which severed the main artery on the left side of the neck. There's uncertainty about whether Stride's murder should be attributed to the Ripper or whether he was interrupted during the attack. This comes from the absence of mutilations to the abdomen. Witnesses who thought they saw Stride with the man earlier that night gave differing descriptions. Some said her companion was fair, others dark. Some said he was shabbily dressed, others well-dressed. And then Eddowes' body was found three-quarters of an hour after Stride's. The throat was severed. The abdomen was ripped open by a long, deep, jagged wound. The left kidney and a major part of the uterus had been removed. So the theory among ripperologists is that he was interrupted during his attempt to murder Stride and went off to find someone else to complete his ritual.
So, again, I know this is more detailed than Ethan has at his thing, but some questions that come to mind. I mean, one, the actual murder itself had to happen less than 45 minutes. And, I mean, we're going to assume that if he is a ritualistic murderer, he would not want to have done it in haste. Mm-hmm. And two, how far apart were these two murders? Because, I mean, if I'm almost caught outside my door, I'm going to want to make sure I'm a couple blocks away before I even think about doing something else, just so that I'm not near the frenzy of the other ones.
Well, the thing about the Ripper murders is that only one of them was committed in a private location. All the other ones were in a public place. So there's lots of speculation about, you know, was it fairly common to see a prostitute getting assaulted on the streets, and that's why nobody noticed? I mean, there's a lot of blood when you literally sever the neck to the point where you almost remove the head.
Well, maybe that actually helps explain some of it. Because, I mean, in the one sense, if you sever the neck, they're not screaming and they're not kicking or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It was all, most of these were done in the dark or at dusk at least, so the growing puddle at the feet would probably have not been that noticed.
Yeah. And there actually is speculation that he actually killed the victims by strangling them and then severed the neck to let the blood out. But again, that's speculation. The final murder is Kelly's. Her mutilated body was discovered laying on a bed in a single room where she lived at 13 Miller's Court at 10:45 a.m. on Friday the 9th, November 1888. The throat had been severed down to the spine, and the abdomen virtually emptied of its organs, and the heart was missing. So in addition to the Canonical Five murders, sharing all the facts about the, gruesomeness, they were all perpetuated at night, on or close to a weekend. At either the end of a month or a week or so after, the mutilations became increasingly severe as the murders proceeded, except for that of Stride, who may have been interrupted. Nichols was not missing any organs. Chapman's uterus was taken. Eddowes had her uterus and kidney removed and her face mutilated. Kelly's body was eviscerated and her face hacked away, and her heart was missing from the crime scene.
Well, so again, I'm playing devil's advocate here. That, in one sense, there's sort of an evolving pathology here, right? I mean, it's becoming progressively worse as time goes by. And it's quite common for people who do serial killers to keep souvenirs of their case, but usually they tend to keep a similar souvenir. And I guess an internal body organ might qualify. I mean, maybe he's building a new woman. But you said some things that made my bells go off. So you said close to or on a weekend. So Thursday, Friday, Monday, Tuesday, well, that's 90% of the week right there. Mm-hmm. And on or close to the end of the month, well, again, that's at least 50% of the month right there. So those strike me as rather wide error bars as far as saying those are, you know, oh, we can pin them down because of this.
Yeah, and part of the reason why that was suggested is because people have speculated that perhaps Jack the Ripper had a sort of 9-to-5 type job in the daytime and committed his murders at night when he had free time. which is kind of a disturbing thought to think about in the first place. But
everyone needs a hobby.
Yeah, I guess. Well, let's go to a quick commercial break. We'll let our audience sort of de-stress after hearing all that scary stuff. And we'll talk about who was Jack the Ripper. Stay tuned.
Got to clean the studio up anyhow.
Yeah, it's all bloody.
The best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So we're discussing Jack the Ripper. And who was Jack the Ripper? Because this is the point of the topic. I recently saw an article about a new book with a dramatic conclusion about the Whitechapel murders. The perpetrator, it is claimed, was in fact a woman, none other than Lizzie Williams, wife of royal physician Sir John Williams, who was also a suspect in the murders. This new theory is quite sensational, but could it be true? So the book, entitled Jack the Ripper, The Hand of a Woman, by retired lawyer John Morris, claims the evidence is overwhelming and that it suggests the murderer is Lizzie Williams because none of the women were sexually assaulted.
So is that his only, it is obviously this person? Because he says overwhelming. So what is the overwhelming evidence he provides besides the sexual assault?
Well, he claims that personal items were laid out at the feet of Chapman in a typically feminine manner.
What is the scientific definition of a feminine manner?
I don't know.
No.
He also says three small buttons from a woman's boot were found in blood near Catherine Eddowes. And remnants of women's clothing, a cape, skirt, and hat, were found in the ashes of Mary Kelly's fireplace, and Mary had never been seen wearing them. Now, Morris also claims that Lizzie was infertile. She couldn't have children. And since all the victims were prostitutes, and three had their wombs removed, it is an indication that Lizzie had gone insane over her infertility. There's also the suggestion that Kelly was having an affair with Lizzie's husband, Sir John, and also that Sir John ran abortion clinics in Whitechapel, which might also explain why the murder stopped after Kelly was killed.
So, I mean, A, if she was inspired to do this because of an affair by her husband, why wasn't Kelly the first one to be killed? Is it true that Sir John was running an abortion clinic? Is that one of the empirical facts we have?
Well, see, the interesting thing about Sir John, I looked up why he was a suspect, and he was a more modern, in relative terms, suspect, because somebody wrote a book claiming to be a descendant of his, saying that, oh yes, I found evidence that he was the murderer. It was examined by forensic experts, and ultimately the verdict was, this is a hoax. So I don't think we can reasonably say that Sir John was a suspect. Whether or not he ran an abortion clinic in Whitechapel, whether or not he was having an affair with Kelly, I think are probably inventions of the original hoax.
It was actually one of the ironies of the Victorian age is that, I mean, a lot of the noble men were getting a lot on the side. I mean, one of the reasons why you had 12,000 prostitutes working there is because they had work to do. I mean, it wasn't like they were there hoping that they might earn a living, but
yeah.
So it wouldn't have been uncommon for that aspect to have been true.
Right. I mean, like, other than that, like, what do you think of the evidence?
Well, again, you know, based on my limited, and I granted it's limited pathology, but if she had a fixation on fertility, again, the uterus would have been a constant thing and not a variable thing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you said, what the other one took part of the kidney, right? So, I mean, again, perhaps sloppy work. I mean, that's always a potential. But the heart, I mean, that would be, I mean, that becomes a useful sort of post hoc explanation as to why the last one lost heart because it was an affair. But again, if she killed her because of an affair, then why wasn't she the first one to sort of die? And so there's a lot of, it looks like, cherry picking of evidence.
Well, you mentioned post hoc, and that's really important because when you're trying to establish a conspiracy theory, and I'm going to call this a conspiracy theory, it's very useful to go back and anomaly hunt and assume that there was some kind of agency based on what limited facts we have. So we know Kelly had her heart removed. Oh, well, that obviously means that it was done by somebody who wanted to, you know, throw it at the feet of her cheating husband and be like, look what I have done to your mistress, right? So, I mean, I don't know. Post hoc reasoning, to me, doesn't seem to work out very often in this sort of thing.
Well, it even extends, too. I mean, the fact that someone is opening up women and taking bodily parts out, you know, this woman had her heart removed, therefore it has to be related to these ones who had their uteruses removed. I mean, it's a much closer tie, but I mean, it's still, there's a bit of cherry picking to that, to a degree. Less of a degree, but to a degree.
Well, who are the other suspects?
I mean, I wasn't there.
I'm not asking you. Virtually everyone who was alive during the times of the murders has been accused by some Richard today. If we ignore the sort of wild speculation and focus on the suspects that London's Metropolitan Police Service had, we get four. There was Kosminski, a poor Polish Jewish resident in Whitechapel. Montagu John Derut, a 31-year-old barrister and schoolteacher who committed suicide in December 1888. Michael Ostrog, a Russian-born multi-synonymous thief and confidence trickster, believed to be 55 years old in 1888 and was detained in an asylum on several occasions. And Dr. Francis J. Tumblety, a 56-year-old American, quote, quack doctor, who was arrested in November 1888 for offenses of gross indecency and fled the country later that month, obtaining bail at a very high price.
Well, wait a minute. Where are the royals? I mean, every conspiracy theory I've ever heard about Jack the Ripper includes one of the princes.
Yeah. Well, that's the wild speculation part. The interesting thing about the doctor, some have speculated that the gruesomeness of the murders would not be possible having, you know, organs removed without medical background. So, although he's a quack doctor, I don't know whether that syncs up there.
Well, I was actually listening to Skeptoid, and they were talking about this, and that actually that's one of those myths that it wasn't actually well removed, that anyone could have sort of just hacked away. It wasn't surgical other than the fact that they used a very sharp knife to open the body up.
So the first of these three suspects was nominated by Sir Melville MacNaughton, who joined the Metropolitan Police as Assistant Chief Constable, and he was second in command to the Criminal Investigation Department at Scotland Yard. Kosminski was the favored suspect by the head of the CID, Dr. Robert Anderson, and the officer in charge of the case, Chief Inspector Don Swanson. Druid appears to have been MacNaughton's preferred candidate, while the fact that Ostrog was arrested and incarcerated before the report was compiled leaves us skeptical as to why he was considered a viable suspect in the first place. The fourth suspect, the doctor, was stated to have been, quote, amongst the suspects at the time of the murders, and, quote, to my mind, a very likely one by the ex-head of the Special Branch of Scotland Yard in 1888, ex-detective Chief Inspector John George Littlechild. We can also note that Sir John Williams was not considered a suspect. So arguments can be made against all of them being the culprit, and there's no hard evidence that exists against any of them. So obviously the fact that the police were at no point where they could make a case against anyone, how likely is it that a case can be made by somebody now in the modern times?
Well, again, I mean, it's like trying to find the tomb of Jesus or, you know, the Spanish Inquisition. I mean, perhaps the one slight difference is, I mean, it is more closer to hand. And you had mentioned that they had tried to use some more modern techniques. I think one of the ones we talked about before the show was photography, which, you know, seems to be great because there are, ironically enough, a lot of records about this particular case, even though there doesn't seem to be a lot of hard evidence, at least in the sense that we tend to think of it. There's no CIS sort of moments in this.
Yeah. Although, I mean, like, it is kind of like, you know, CSI 1888 or something, because they were trying a lot of different things. And that idea that, you know, the police at the time, oh, whatever, the prostitutes, we don't care. But they actually seem to be pretty, you know, hell-bent, if I can use that word, on tracking down this killer.
Well, wasn't this one of the things, I mean, the whole reason why Jack the Ripper is such a cultural meme is the fact that this was also picked up by the papers.
Oh, yeah.
And became one of those sensational stories, which Absolutely. Is why, you know, I mean, maybe this even wasn't one person, but maybe several, or maybe, you know, there's a lot of other aspects to it. But this became such an important issue because it was driven by the media press. I'm not sure if that's the best reason, but it still seemed to have been one of the reasons why it's such a cultural meme. And also one of the reasons why I think there's a lot of confusion. Again, we were talking before the show, the word Jack the Ripper, I think, was first used by someone who wrote a letter to the Metropolitan Police, and that's where that sort of term came out. And that there wasn't like they have a suspect and they think his name is Jack. It's just this was pulled really from thin air.
Oh, yeah.
Because that letter itself, I think, has been discredited strongly.
Yeah, I believe so. And the question ultimately becomes, will this case ever have resolution? And I personally don't think so. Because when you look at what the evidence actually tells us, it's not much. The facts that we have about the murders, the facts that the investigators had at the time, is really tenuous and weak. It's really unlikely that we will ever know who the real killer was. In addition, you get the fact that the suspects who are accused years after the murders, I mean, they include anyone who has any kind of remote connection to the case. You mentioned the Royals. I mean, they're a huge target for this sort of thing. I don't quite understand that, but I guess...
Well, no, the Royals had the thing. One, they were popular,
yeah.
But one of the things was this mysterious, and the conspiracy mind comes into this, right? Who had the power to suppress all the evidence? And everyone said, oh, well, the Royals obviously did.
Yeah.
But so what are some of the, you know, important points to consider with regards to this killer?
Well, one thing is that this is a very publicized case, as you mentioned. So during the time of the murders, newspapers, tabloids, gossip, and books were published and circulated, all trying to cash in on the murders and public interest. There are numerous fake letters and hoaxes that were probably invented by like a newspaper reporter trying to find a scoop. Given all this, it's extremely difficult to nail down what is solid evidence and what is myth. Another important fact that, like I mentioned before, contrary to opinion, the detectives working this case actually did a fairly decent job investigating. And when we look at the evidence that they presented, the evidence that we consider reliable, there's just not enough of it to make firm conclusions.
Well, I imagine another huge issue would be, because you'd mentioned something like buttons and all that, but this was a public area, well-trodden, and the idea of preserving a crime scene would not have been something that they would have thought of that much. So I imagine a lot of the evidence that they did collect could have been contaminated one way or other, or wasn't evidence of this crime, but someone had just happened to lose a couple of buttons in the scene.
Yeah. I mean, in a place that was frequented by lots of prostitutes, it's probably not surprising to find articles of clothing here and there.
Well, and if you can murder somebody in public, I imagine a lot of roughhousing, if I can use that term, happened on a common basis.
The other thing that I think is interesting about this case is that there's not even sort of a potential suspect. We mentioned those four or five people, but it's not like, you know, the Zodiac murders where you had a suspect who was, there seemed to be, you know, a certain evidence pointing at, but was never convicted. Whereas here, there's no suspect. We don't even have anyone. We can't point anything at anybody at this point. And of course, you know, when it comes back to Lizzie Williams, I mean, the fact that her connection to the case is her husband, who appears to be a forged connection by a modern author. It's unlikely that Lizzie Williams was connected to the murders. I mean, it is possible that Jack Ripper was a woman. I'm not saying she wasn't. Could very well be. And you know, it's just going to be one of those, I think, enduring mysteries. What might we need to find the real killer? I think we need like a smoking gun. We would need some kind of document, and it would have to be linked in a way that could provide conclusive evidence. So maybe like we find his weapons, clothing, evidence that purports a link to his victims. Because I mean, there have been fake Ripper diaries that have been investigated by people like Joe Nickel and demonstrated to be false. So it's going to take quite a lot to eventually solve the crime. And don't hold your breath. My guess is that it won't be solved anytime soon.
We could always use the Wayback Machine.
The Wayback Machine?
Yes.
You mean travel back in time to investigate? See, that seems like a frivolous use of time travel. Like, to go back in time to figure out who the killer was instead of stopping the killer. Like,
oh, yeah, well, I guess you do have a point there. But, I mean, from our perspective, it'd be much more interesting to find out. I mean, after all, society has not suffered from the loss of these people, have they?
Well,
every life is sacred, I know.
We don't know what they could have amounted to. Maybe they would have, you know, come up with a time travel device or something.
Now that would be irony.
Yes. Well, we're actually right out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. We should go to our skeptical highlights.
I have two this week.
Just two?
Yeah, I know. Last week I kind of overdid it, so I'm trying to wean myself off of highlights. First of all, is Unveiling the Universe. Triumph in the Science World presents a lecture from CERN Director General Rolf Hauer about the quest to understand space and time. Topics will include things like the ephemeral neutron that appears to disobey Einstein's law, doppelganger-like anti-atoms likely never seen before in the universe, and the fantastic search for one of the fundamental particles to rule them all, the Dawn boson. Okay, it's the Higgs boson, which should be called Dawn. This event is happening June 3rd from 6 to 8 p.m. It's at the OmniMax Theater. Apparently, admission is free, so woohoo! That would be a cool thing to see. Another one on a more political bent, my apologies. This Wednesday at 8 p.m., at the Art Gallery, there is going to be a Vancouver's own casserole demonstration in support of the protesters in Quebec, who are both, one, protesting tuition fee increases, and also the new law that Quebec has passed to reduce or prevent protests, which is not quite as horrible as I had heard it to be. I read through it recently. It is bad, and actually the biggest things is if you're a student union, you can be fined for every offense up to something like $250,000 for offense, which seems a bit odious. And actually, ironically enough, and not that anyone really cares, why is it called the casserole protest? Apparently this has a link back to a protest they did in Chile about Pinochet, and Argentina and Pinochet, where they got pots and pans on the street to protest, and it was making reference to a stewing pot of protest. So that's
interesting.
Fine. Yeah,
that's neat.
So get out your pots and pans and make some noise.
It's not a mosaic of outrage. It's a melting pot.
Exactly, and it's not a protest against casserole. The people at this protest think casserole is a perfectly acceptable kind of food. Not that anyone should have to have past casserole, but it's good to have. Right?
I appreciate that of them.
Yes.
Yeah. My skeptical highlight is there is a new Skeptics in the Pub launching in the Vancouver area. This one is going to be in New Westminster, and it's having its inaugural meeting Sunday, June 3rd at 1 p.m. It's sort of a get-together for brunch to sort of meet everybody, say hi, that kind of thing.
Sort of and a then, Skeptics in the Brunch.
Sure, why not? And after that, they're going to discuss the location and when they want to have their meetings and all that kind of stuff. You know, Skeptics in the Pub is a really great community event. Just go there and hang out with some like-minded folks. So I do encourage you to go by if you're in the area. It's got great transit from pretty much any part of the Vancouver area, so you really can't go wrong. It's at the Met Bar and Grill at 411 Columbia Street, New Westminster. And it's right near the Columbia SkyTrain station, so you're within walking distance. And apparently it's a very nice neighborhood, so go on by, say hi, and see if you can help start that Skeptics in the Pub in New West.
Which is always, always a good thing to do. The more we can do, go out there and promote skepticism in the world is a better thing. And if we can have a good time while doing it, more power to us.
Yeah. That's like the mission statement of our podcast.
I think it is.
Yes, absolutely. Well, speaking of our podcast, it's coming to an end. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, minds open, eyes on.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy.
zeros.